Thank you, Sally, for reading that for us. Famous words, very famous words, these six short verses, and very familiar to lots of us, I'm sure. They say that smell is the best sense when it comes to invoking certain memories. That could be in a general way where a certain smell reminds you of kind of a whole load of memories from a similar time or place rolled into one. For me, the smell of freshly cut grass takes me straight back to, as a child, me and my brothers would chase my dad around the garden as he mowed the lawn, and as he'd take the grass cuttings out of the basket to go and chuck them in the compost heap, we would sort of rush in from kicking a football around, and we try and race to scoop up the biggest handfuls of grass that spilled out. And that was just something we found ridiculously fun. And that's what cut grass reminds me of. I don't think that the smell of cut grass would remind anyone else of that memory, probably not even my dad or my brothers, but it takes me back there. And that's a whole load of memories that kind of get tangled together. For other people, there are smells which have a very, very acute memory attached to them. If you were someone who was caught in a house fire once, then the smell of smoke will always remind you of the feelings of that time. I think that the Psalms can do a very similar thing, and particularly this psalm, for so many people, has different times of their life and different memories attached to it. Maybe it's in the more general sense where there's a time, a season of your life where you could relate to what this psalmist is writing about a sense of peacefulness, of green pastures and still waters, and there's a good thing there. Maybe it's the later verses talking about dark valleys and it's less good memories that are associated with this, where you felt like you were in that place, and that's how you can relate to this psalm. For some, there's a more specific memory. It's a very common passage to be read at funerals, and for some people, every time they hear these words, it takes them back to that funeral, remembering that particular loved one. And these things are things that we can't help, these associations. And in some ways, it's good that we have associations with a psalm like this, with poetry like this. But we need to make sure that when these things are conjured up in our minds, that we understand what the psalmist was trying to say about God and see those scenarios, those situations, those times in our life through the lens that the psalmist wants us to see them through. The first thing that I want us all to know as we come to this psalm is that this is a psalm of life. Though it's so common at funerals, it's a psalm about life, not about death. The focus on death, the dark valley, that's not the heart of this psalm. It's a psalm of life. These are words which the psalmist, who in this case was David, the king of Israel, he writes, and it's a description that he thinks a follower of God should be able to have this experience in this life. And sometimes we can associate the imagery in this psalm, the green pastures, the still waters, the feast in the presence of your enemies. You can think of that as so utopian and so idealistic that we can't really associate that with this life. And we think that maybe that is something about the life of the age to come. It's a description of heaven or somewhere in eternity future. But for David, that isn't on his radar here. And so I'm glad that we read from a translation that in the first line captures that, because a familiar translation of that first line may be, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," which is a good translation, and we'll sing a song later on which kind of takes that version. But it can sort of let us push that into the future somewhere. We can imagine that one day we shall not want in the future, that God's going to take us into the new creation and then we won't want anything. But that's not what David is getting at here. There's an immediacy to it. David is saying that in this life, I lack nothing. Oh, I think that the translation we heard was, I have everything that I need. And that is talking about now. It's not something that we can push into the future. And so, is that an experience that we can relate to? Is that realistic for believers, for Christians in this life? Because it often doesn't feel like it. Now, we know that David was a king, and we don't know at what point of his life he wrote this psalm. It could have been when he was a king, and in that case, it's easy to see how he could say, I lack nothing. He had the riches of the whole kingdom at his disposal. Easy for him to say. It could have been that he wrote this or started to develop this sort of thinking when he was a shepherd boy himself, though. When he was the youngest of a large family, looked down on by his brothers, and he really could have said, had he wanted to, that he was pretty hard off. It doesn't really matter at what point David wrote this. Perhaps you know the legend. It may or may not have happened, but it captures something helpful of John D. Rockefeller, who at his time was the richest man in the world. His wealth is thought to be, in kind of contemporary terms, about 10 times that of someone like Bill Gates. He really had all that he could have. And yet, allegedly, when a journalist asked him, how much money would you need to be content? His answer was, just a little bit more. Lacking nothing is not about what you've actually got. It's not about riches or wealth. The data, whether that is a legend that didn't happen, whether he did say that to someone, the data is that people from the poorest of the poor to the richest of the rich, when surveyed, always perceive themselves as being less well off than their peers. They always think that the person who has a similar job in a similar company to them has more money, is better off, and that they would be better off if they could just match that. David didn't say, I lack nothing, because of the riches he had at a time in his life. He said it because he knew who had his back. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. This is getting into imagery that we can kind of imagine, but it's unfamiliar in other ways, and we can miss some of the nuances of it. Because when I picture green pastures, I think of somewhere like Wales, where there's grass everywhere, because it's the greatest place in the world. And it's beautiful. Rolling hills full of happy sheep. And the sheep can just live in one place all year round, and they will be happy. They will never run out of food. They will never run out of grass. But David is writing about the ancient Near East, which is very different. It's mostly wilderness, it's mostly desert. There are just patches of grass, few and far between. So when David describes God making him lie down in a green pasture, what he's saying is that the pasture that he is in at that time is so abundant in its provision that not only is it good enough for this meal, but he can lie down and rest knowing it's good enough for the next one as well. The sheep don't need to immediately move on to go wandering, following the shepherd to the next pasture where there's going to be a bit more grass. This one has enough. David knows that God's abundant provision is enough for him to rest. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. David knows that God provides for us not just to help us scrape by, not just leading us to the pasture which can provide the next meal before you have to move on, but for us to be able to rest and to live with restored souls, with refreshed souls. But it only works if the sheep trust the shepherd. It only works if the sheep believe that the shepherd is the one who really knows whether it's time for them to move on to the next pasture or not, time to go looking for the next meal, or whether this one will be sufficient. If the sheep wander off on their own, then actually the chances of them finding the next meal are pretty slim. They're just going to be wandering in random directions, and they're going to end up in much greater need than if they had just stayed put and trusted the shepherd. But sometimes the shepherd will call the sheep to follow him and leave one pasture before all the grass has gone, because he knows that they have had just enough to eat. He knows that their energy levels are at the right point, that they are going to be able to make it to the next pasture. Whereas if they stay here a bit longer and exhaust all of the grass that's available to them here, he knows they won't make it to the next pasture at the right time. I wonder if you've ever been so focused on one pasture, one season of your life, that you've missed God calling you to the next one. Or maybe you have an experience where actually God has called you to stay in a pasture for longer than you really wanted to be. While I was talking to Sarah there, I mentioned my time at Trinity and how tough I found that. And for me, that has been a pasture that God has called me to be in for a lot longer than I wanted to be there. I thought I would be better off if I left, if I went to the next thing. After my first year at Trinity, I've been there for 3 years. At the end of my first year, I'd basically said goodbye to everyone. I'd said, you know, I'm not coming back next year. 90% sure I won't be back. And then I went off and had some time off and prayed about it and felt for some reason that God was calling me to stay there. And so I turned up on the first day of term the next academic year, and everyone was shocked to see me because I'd said I was going. But God called me to stay in that pasture, and it's been a time of learning that having a refreshed and restored soul comes from trusting in God. That I just have to trust him to put me in the right place. And if that place that he has put me isn't refreshing me, isn't restoring me, if I'm not able to live there in that kind of way, and I know it's the right place that God has put me, then there's something that I am doing wrong. I remember just before the pandemic started that my dad and I went skiing with some friends. Dan and Sarah were there, and I had this stack of books on the dashboard, which Dan and Sarah are chuckling because they remember this. I had this stack of books that I planned to read on this holiday. The first one was The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. There was one called Leading on Empty, and there was one called Restoring the Soul of Your Leadership. And one of them kind of looked at this stack and said, "Are you okay, Matt?" And I wasn't. But it wasn't because I was in the wrong place. It was because I hadn't learned to trust the shepherd about how he was going to keep me in that place. David moves on to describe walking through the darkest valley. Sometimes it's translated as the valley of the shadow of death, but it's more a sense of just deep darkness. And it's not necessarily about evil or oppression. Those things may be part of the experience, but it's mostly about uncertainty. It's about just not being able to see where you are going. And if you're in a pitch black, unfamiliar valley, the thing that would probably bring you the most comfort would be to have some source of light that you could put on. It would be to see things clearly, to know where the trip hazards are, to know where the pits you might fall into are, to be able to see that you're not surrounded by some kind of predators. But the psalmist doesn't describe God as giving light in that situation. The valley here, while he's being led through it, is still dark. There's still all that uncertainty. It's more like he's in the valley and has a guide with him. And the guide has night vision goggles on. We don't. When we go through those dark valleys, we're not the ones who are able to see. God isn't necessarily giving us the sight. He's not giving us the night vision goggles. But we're in the valley with one who does have that sight. And so God, the one leading us through the valley, is the one who is equipped for that task. And it's a case of taking his hand and trusting him, even though we still can't see where we're going. The imagery here of the shepherd having the staff and the rod, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Those are things that a shepherd was equipped with for their job. The rod was a tool for fending off predators, and the staff was for guiding, for directing the sheep. God is the one who is equipped to take us through the uncertain times, because he is the one who can see. If you're anything like me, you really like to make decisions based on data. Whether it's when you're going to buy something, you go online, you go on review websites, you talk to people about their opinions, maybe you write pros and cons lists of all sorts of things. Maybe before you go on a journey, you like to check on Google Maps or the AA route planner to see what the traffic and diversions are. We like data to make decisions. And so sometimes in my relationship with God, what I'd really like him to do would be to whip out some PowerPoint slides, have some graphs, show me the data. Like, I'm happy for him to do the legwork on this, but I need him to present to me his reasoning for telling me what to do. And, you know, once I've seen it, I'll be happy that I'm going to do what he has said. But that isn't the life that actually David describes as being the place of knowing for ourselves the provision and the goodness of God. And if we don't learn to just trust him without asking to dig down into the data behind it, then we won't actually experience the rest of green pastures and still waters. Again, as we move to verse 5, it says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows." What this shows us is that troubles in our lives don't contradict the experience that David is describing. Being in this place of rest in God's presence isn't actually at odds with experiencing difficulties and troubles. He acknowledges that he has enemies, and with enemies come stress and struggles and strife. But it's precisely while he is surrounded by his enemies that he finds more of God's goodness and sustenance. It is God who holds the enemies at bay so they can only watch on as David gets to feast in God's presence and experience the overflowing cup of God's love. It's there for us to experience in the middle of difficulty and trying times. But David has to trust God for it. He has to make himself vulnerable, exposed. He has to sit at the table that God has prepared, to eat and drink, to have his hands full of the good stuff that God is giving him rather than a hand on his sword or his bow or his slingshot or whatever it would be. He has to trust God that he won't be disadvantaged in the battles that he has to face with these enemies by taking the time out to rest in his presence. The message of this psalm of life, at every twist and every turn, is that actively placing trust in God is the way that we will experience true rest and the restoration of our souls. There isn't a plea in this psalm. So many psalms, they go from kind of praising God to asking God for something. This is never a plea. This is purely trust. This is just David saying, "God, I trust you." He doesn't have to ask God to come through for him because he trusts that it's going to happen. And that's the way that we will get to know God's goodness for ourselves. to have stories that we can remember, that we can share with other people, testimonies of God's goodness, will come from trusting him. Theoretical trust isn't trust. Singing songs which say, I trust you, and then not putting yourself in a position where you have to trust God, isn't the kind of trust that God is looking for. Saying that we trust God, but making sure that we only do it when we've got a good plan B, isn't the way that we're going to experience this stuff. The gospel story that captures it best is Jesus calling Peter to step out of the boat, to walk on the water. That's kind of the classic sermon on trust, and you know, it's a great one. But if Peter had responded in that story when Jesus calls him to step out of the boat and said, you know what, Jesus, that is a great idea. That sounds like a good experience. Totally up for that. Let me just row back to shore. I'll pop into my house. I'll get my armbands and a change of clothes just in case this doesn't work out too well. Then I'll come back and meet you here. And then I'll step out of the boat. He'd have missed it. It wouldn't have been the same experience. It wouldn't be the level of trust that our shepherd longs for from us. But in my life, I'm so used to only doing things if I know that I've got a good backup plan, a good insurance policy, a good safety net. But what I'm coming to learn is that you can only know for yourself that the shepherd is good if you stake something on it. If you risk actually losing something, if it turns out that he's not. To actively put yourselves in positions where if you're wrong about what you think God is saying, then maybe you're going to be embarrassed. Maybe you're going to find it tough. The restoration of our souls takes place in the pastures of trusting God. It might be trusting him that actually you can take a day off every week, that you can switch your emails off and the world isn't going to implode. You're still going to have a job on Monday. Trusting maybe that giving the first 10% of your paycheck away will not result in you actually being hard off by the end of the month. Trusting sometimes that it's time to close one door before you can see the next one open, before you know how you're going to make ends meet if you leave that job right now. God calls us to be trusting people, people who live lives where we don't do things only when we've got that plan B, that insurance policy. We need to be people who need him to be true to his word, if we're not going to fall flat on our faces. And that is something that I've found through this journey at Trinity, being desperate to leave, but just having this sense that for whatever reason, I was in the right place. I have learned to feel restored and refreshed. To put in place good rhythms of actually taking a day off each week. And that was one of the things that I just wasn't doing. And I had to trust God that, you know, if I didn't reply to those messages on a Saturday, that actually everything was going to be okay. What I'm doing at the moment, what this looks like in my life, is getting married in August, starting this job in October. It's kind of scary because this job is going to have me on the road Monday to Friday. I'm going to be away most of the time while learning to be married, to be a good husband, to build that relationship. And that really scares me. Honestly, on paper, I don't really see how those things fit together to enable sort of flourishing of both work and home life. We talked a bit about my musical theatre years that I went through, and I loved that. I was really passionate about that. Being a musical theatre actor would have been kind of my dream job at the time, and I was really close to that. I was auditioning at my dream drama school, and they said, you know, just come back for one more audition. We'll probably give you a place. If we don't, we know that another top drama school is going to. But through the process, actually, I'd come to realize that I didn't want to do that, because on the other side of it, most of the work would be touring. It would be being away for months at a time. And I realized that, you know, one day, hopefully I'd meet someone and want to settle down, have a family, that kind of thing. And I didn't want to leave that, to be on tour all of the time. So it wasn't a situation that I ended up pursuing. And now here we are in something that is not quite as bad, but it feels like God's leading me into something pretty similar to that, being away so much more than I feel comfortable with. But through the process of considering this job, it was clear that it fit with the gifts that he's given me and the passions that he's given me. And I just prayed as I tried that door, and it felt like he didn't just fling the door wide open, but rolled out the red carpet and made it as easy as possible. I've got this job in a company full of people who are basically, everyone's an Oxbridge graduate with a science degree or an engineering degree, most of them masters and PhDs, and I'm here with my theology degree from Trinity College Bristol, and that really entertained them when I got through to the final stage of the interviews. Then they were like, how did you get here? How did you get past all the tests and the hurdles that you set up? And maybe I should have been more brave and said, God got me past them, because that's what I think. But I'm sure I laughed it off and didn't say anything quite so bold at the time. But I'm trusting God, because I feel like he has put me in this position, in this job, and so I know that it's going to work out. But I've got a lot to lose, a lot of pain ahead if it doesn't work out. And so that's what it looks like. And that's what I think David came to know through his life, through being a shepherd, through being the shepherd king of Israel. That we need to just trust God. And all I know is that if I want to experience the peace and the abundance and the joy of the green pastures and the still waters that David experienced, the presence of the living God, then I have to trust that the good shepherd knows something that I don't. And if that means risking everything to follow his direction, then that's what I'm called to. No plan B, no insurance policy, no safety net. This is where God promises that we will find his presence and his life. Amen.